Chuck. I was born in Ontario. And I was married in Ontario and later we came to BC and was divorced and married my husband, who was Harold Burchett, trade union leader. He started in the early 20s being interested in trade unions, and his first card that he took out was 1923, I believe. So he has a long history in the trade union movement. Harold had 5 children, and they were all born in BC.
Do they all live here now?
They all live in BC. Mm-hmm.
And they continue, all of them have been active?
They have been active at one time or another. The oldest boy was with the Longshore Union for many years, and another one was with the electrical workers, active in the union. A third one was in the office workers union. Another one was in the electrical workers, and then later on in the office workers union, Ruby T. Hyman. And the other boy was with the Teamsters, so they all had trade union.
Just the sound of your last name must have put a shudder through some employers.
Well, that may be so. I know that when I was working here, after having worked in the trade union movement and with the BC Federation of Labor. Now, I'll give you some background on that. The BC Federation of Labor, CCL, was reformed in about 1945. And up until that point, there was the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council, the AFL, and it was also a Vancouver Labor Council, CLC. And it was deemed advisory at the time to set up the BC Federation of Labor as a legislative arm of labor. And so that, of course, was to attract the CLC unions. And when I say CLC, that's Canadian Labor Congress. It's now called Canadian Congress of Labor.
Right. Right. So many name changes. When you read about it, you don't understand a lot of it. It gets really confusing, all these different initials. I had to write them down and go back and try to understand them again.
So about one of the first big projects with the BC Federation of Labor, at which time I was secretary in that office, was when the Nanaimo laundry workers went on strike. And at that time we were faced with a Tory-Liberal combination in the legislature. And they decided that they were going to enact legislation that would put those workers back to work without any gains at all. And that was when the BC Federation of Labor was instrumental in getting the AFL unions to work with them to defeat Bill 39, which was the one that they put on the statutes at that time, which was also a union-busting piece of legislation. But anyway, that's only as far as it goes within that particular job. But to get on with this, you asked about, is it necessary to maintain your home? I have worked all my life, married or single. And it was necessary to maintain the home because part of the time there wasn't sufficient funds coming in to maintain a home. Sometimes the trade unions couldn't afford to pay enough money at that time. And as far as I was concerned, I enjoyed working, and so I preferred to work. But many times in my life, it was absolutely necessary. There just wasn't enough money coming into the house without my wages.
I often thought when I was reading some of these articles, when there wouldn't necessarily be a full wage coming in from both of you because you're so active, and a lot of times being active doesn't bring in a wage or much money, right?
Right. Now, going back a little bit, I'll give you a little bit of the history of my husband and show you what happened at that time. Now, it didn't relate to me, but it did to Harold's family. That he was the first international president of the International Woodworkers of America. And he was the only Canadian up to that point that held an international position within the trade union.
Mm-hmm.
So they were determined from the United States that they weren't going to have what they considered a left-wing president of the IWA, and he was only allowed to go back and forth on permit. He had applied for citizenship so that he could take his family down to the States, and they refused each time to allow him to have citizenship.
Because of his politics?
Because of his politics, so they said.
Mm.
So he was given a permit, but it was decided by the State Department if he would get that permit, and each time it ran out, he had to come back to Canada and wait for that permit to be reissued. And finally, in 1940, they refused to renew, and so he had to come back to Canada. So as a result of that, he had to resign from the leadership of the International Union. So he came back to Canada, and he assisted with the trade union work here within the union, which wasn't the IWA at the time. Here it was when they were trying to form a union in Canada. And finally, as a result of the fact that there were so few funds in the international, he was never paid the full amount of $70 per week, which was the amount that was stipulated that the president and other officers would make. And so a certain amount was held back. And after he returned to Canada, they decided that they would pay him his back wages. And for a year, he worked on the wages that he had already earned in Canada, helping to organize the woodworkers here. That gives you some idea of why a woman would have to work.
Oh.
I started to work in the hungry 30s. When I came out of school, there were literally no jobs to be found. And about the only place that hired anyone at the time was General Motors. It was called McKinley Industries at the time. And they were a parts plant for General Motors. And at that time, people would go and stand and wait. And if they needed anyone that day, someone would come out and they'd pick you out, you. And that way, if you waited long enough and went day after day after day, you might be lucky and you'd be chosen to go to work. Now, that is how I started. And I went to work as a winder, a motor winder, which later on became a highly skilled job. And now it is not done by hand, it's done by machine. But at that time, women did that work. And these are motors that are for refrigerators. It's a stator part of the motor. It's small motors. And then there's a stator that goes inside and it goes round and round and round. That's what makes the thing work. But the stator is just the part that remains stationary. And in order to wind it, it's coils of wire that go into little slots. And so that was the type of work that I started at.
Did you stand at a bench or
no,
sit?
You sit. You have to sit. Yeah. So anyway, it wasn't until just before the war when a few jobs opened up, and finally I did go back into office work, or went into office work, which I had been trained for. But I might add that during that period of time, that there were many women, teachers and nurses and people with very good educations that also came to work because there was nothing else for them at the time. And the way they worked at General Motors then was they would have an order and they would call in, say, 10 people to complete that order. And they would work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. They would complete the order, and then they'd send everyone home, and then a month or so later, if another order came in, you were on call, and you would be called back in.
That was before?
That was in the 30s.
That was before General Motors was unionized?
Yes. And I was instrumental then, in the organization of the auto workers at that time, because it was part of the auto workers plant, even though the job that I was doing was not part of the auto workers. And I became the first woman to join that union, that particular local, and I became the recording secretary of that local for some years after.
That's a, I don't think, some people think that being the chair sometimes is the most responsible position, but oftentimes they know that the person with the most power in my local is the recording secretary. She's got the handle on everything. And chairs have come and go, but she's been there for a long time, and she's generally telling them what they're doing wrong, correcting them, and she sits there and she whispers to them what they've done wrong and it's working. She's
at that time we were all learning, so I can't say that that my job on the executive was any better than the others, although...
Are you saying there was no labor schools then?
Since I was the only woman, I must say that I ran into a lot of opposition, because if I did raise an objection or an opinion about something, the men were quick to point out that I didn't know what I was talking about.
It sounds like some managers, when I go to them now with as a shop steward with a problem, and they'll say, well, you don't know about this. You have to know about this.
Do you want to shut that off? I had already mentioned that the conditions of work was such that if they had an order, then either all of the crew would be called in, and they would work, depending on how fast they wanted that order out, they'd work 12 hours a day, sometimes 7 days a week. It was a piecework job, but the rate was 25 cents an hour. And of course, if you were to go below that in your piecework rate, well, you wouldn't last very long. Safety conditions weren't, in that department, weren't too important. In the first agreement that was signed by the union, safety conditions were put into the contract. Now you're asking about were men and women separated in the workplace. Now, in this particular job that I had, it was only women that did the winding. There were no men at that time. And generally speaking, the men and women were separated. You know, they would have groups. One of the early ways of controlling the workplace at the time was it was group incentive. So a group of people would work together, and presumably, if one fell by the wayside, the others had to pull them along with them in order to keep the whole unit up to 100% or whatever way they worked it. So they were pretty well separated. The women did some jobs that may have been involved in the group, but they weren't part of that working group. That's all I can tell you about that, because I didn't actually work in that part of it. And I think I mentioned that there were different races in the plant, and it was very obvious that the foreign-born workers were the ones that worked in the foundry. The foundry is where they forge steel and parts that would be put into the General Motors product.
And the men that worked in the foundry?
The foreign-born men worked in the foundry. Very few Anglos worked in the foundry.
And would the pay be relative to the dangerous work conditions?
Well, at that time the pays were so very low, even after the first union agreement, wages were pretty low at that time, and for me, I wouldn't know just how it would compare from one place to another, but foundry workers had very, very few amenities. You know, it was a dirty, hot, hard job.
Well, it must be very dangerous.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
And how many of them had health problems since then?
I don't know. See, I left in 1944 and came up here. And I had, as I told you, I left General Mills. As when the war came on, there were more jobs and offices, and so I went to work in an office. So I left that particular area of work and moved down. Women receive equal benefits. Women have never received equal benefits. I think that's a general statement.
Do you think we ever will?
Well, I think it's changing slowly. And I think I've already answered of working once married.
Mm-hmm.
How the community viewed women working. Well, I think a survey was made just a year or so back, and they said that there were only 5% of women in the workforce in 1940. So I was one of the 5%.
In 1940? Mm-hmm. Well, did it go up quite a bit in the next two or 3 years at that time, right?
Well, now there's about 60% of women in the workforce.
And a very high percentage of working women are working, married women are now
yes.
working. It's a small segment now that the women stay in the home.
And the question of housework is always one that comes up. In my own case, I worked and I did my housework on weekends. And I made my meals either the night before or when I came home. And luckily I had a steam pressure cooker, so that was almost like having a microwave today.
Yeah.
And so it was very handy. And the housework doesn't get done by anyone. Usually the woman. The men too help once in a while, but it's not an accepted thing, or it wasn't when I was working, and so I found that I actually did most of the work myself. When I first became active in the trade union movement, the next time I became active in the trade union movement was after arriving in BC, and I was a member of the Office Workers Union, and that was AFL. It was a very small union and mainly had membership within the trade union offices. At that time, the trade union offices were quite concerned that we weren't expanding into other offices. And so we went to the Trade and Labor Council and we asked the committee, which was set up at that time, on organization, if they could assist us in organizing office workers. Well, they didn't come through with very much, so we set up a committee and we decided that we'd have to try ourselves. So I thought I'd raise this because it's a little bit funny. We didn't know quite where to start, so we first went through the directory and we selected names of office workers and we made up a leaflet and we mailed them out, hoping that we would get some interest. Well, that didn't work too well, so then we decided that we would tackle an office where there was some industry organized, and that was McMillan Grodat. And they had an office down on West Hastings Street. So one morning, another woman and myself went along to this office, and we had the trips to the group, so
I can just imagine this.
We went up on the elevator, and the elevator opened out into the main office of the McMillan Hotel.
And the two of you were
standing with our leaflets, so we handed them out to everyone, bosses included.
Oh, you just walked through the office?
We just stood at the, when the doors opened to the elevator, we stood inside and handed out the leaflets. So, naturally,
they never said a word.
never said a word, let us go to it, and so we added them out, but of course at that time we had no results there. However, we went a little further. We had one person that worked in a trust company, and I can't remember the name of that trust company now, but she was instrumental in getting a few of them to come and have a meeting with us. And it was a very young group of people in our office and very poorly paid. So anyway, naturally, they were interested in getting a raise in wages.
Did they think of themselves as only working for a short time, or were they going to be working to support themselves?
Well, there were young boys as well as young women.
Okay.
So it was very difficult to say what their future would be, but their immediate concern was more money. So anyway, they did join the union. And so we discovered later that this was quite a big trust company, and they sent to England for their vice president to come and handle this matter.
Oh, yeah.
So what happened is, at that time, you had to have a signed card, and the employee had to have paid their initiation and first month's dues to become a member of the union,
mm-hmm.
to qualify. And from then, it went to the Labor Relations Board to determine whether or not we'd be certified. So anyway, we had gone through this procedure, and when the vice president came into town, we discovered that a meeting had been called of the Labor Board, and that we were called in to establish this certification. Well, they had taken every single one of those employees and brought them to the Labor Relations Board hearing and put them on the stand so that they could say that they didn't really want the union. And so we never did get the certification.
Well, if this Bill 19 gets in, that would make it legal again.
That's right.
But up right now, that would be totally illegal for them to do
that. That's right.